The following program is presented by the Nerdy Show Podcast Network, geeky programming for all nerds across the multiverse. All Nerdy Show programming is made possible by A Comic Shop, Orlando's number one comic shop and nerd destination, and with the generous support of listeners like you. For more Nerdy Show podcasts, community forums, and learn how you can support this and other Nerdy Show programming, visit nerdyshow.com.
Welcome to Flame On. I am Brian. I have here my brother Jeff.
How's it going, guys?
We are here to get today, not to gay, but we're here, we could be here to gay as well. We are here today to talk about something we've promised for a long time. We are going to talk all about the show Hannibal.
Although now it's like an in memoriam.
It is and it isn't. This is the thing. We'll get to that. But first and foremost, we do want you to know that Flame On, if you've never heard us before, and I don't know why you'd be stumbling upon us. It's not like we're on the terrestrial radio, but we are a gay, geeky podcast. However, today we have 50-50 gay, straight, non-breeding, and absolutely just recently finished breeding, or started breeding? I don't know.
I did put a lot of work into it, and I'd like to say I think I did a pretty good job.
He is adorable. As you probably have heard, if you are a listener that has been with us for a while, on our 100th episode, Jeff was floating around, tending to little baby Henry, and doing
Henry,
other things.
Let's not forget, since this is the geek in me, Henry Norrin, the first name of the Silver Surfer, Norrin Rad.
How
that
could
is
I
Henry's
forget?
Middle name.
I mean, I think that's like, if I can have a theme in things I get you for him or get him, it has to be that.
Oh, who well, else? You know. Well, I was just talking. I've been selling some of my physical comic books as a means to, you know, complete the switch to digital. And I was tempted to, but I will never be able to bring myself to selling my complete run of Silver Surfer Volume 3. That's like over 130 or 40 issues. And that's the one book I'll keep, I think.
I mean, this is totally not the topic, but I will just jump in to say I agree completely, except that I think later in the run there's probably some issues you could part with. But
the completionist in me, I have to have the whole thing.
Yeah, I don't blame you entirely. So yeah. If you've heard us for a while, you know we're big fans of Hannibal. Jeff and myself, and then Pat, who could not be with us, he's recovering from an operation and is healing up. We are huge Hannibal fans. We've watched it all three seasons.
Would you call us Fannibals?
I think no, and I would say that the Fannibals, of course, fans of Hannibal, just, you know, make sure we're clear. They're more interactive with Brian Fuller on Twitter. I would say, I mean, you can call yourself a Fannibal and not be that person, but I wouldn't deign myself as that level of fan. I love the show. I mean, I've certainly bought the DVDs or Blu-rays, bought the soundtracks, talk about it as many times as I can. I mean, it's not quite Doctor Who to me, but it's up.
But this is one of, like, you have had a long list of Fuller shows. This is probably the first one that I have really come to appreciate very much.
You didn't get into Pushing Daisies this much?
I'd never watched Pushing Daisies.
What?
I never watched it.
What? Are you kidding me?
Every time that you would talk about it or I would see any kind of ads for it, it seemed so saccharine sweet that it was almost off-putting. Like, I could never get near it because it seemed so just joyful and over the top and just, like I said, so sweet and romantic. Like, just not my cup of tea normally.
I get that. And honestly, I wouldn't be that into it either. But there's something about Pushing Daisies. Now, of course, Brian Fuller, showrunner, creator of both shows, Wonder Falls, Dead Like Me somewhat. I think he was a co-creator.
First season.
Now doing the Neil Gaiman adaptation, or the adaptation of Neil Gaiman's American Gods for Starz. Most recently, I don't know if Jeff, you knew this, he is working on Spielberg's Amazing Stories.
I had seen a mention of that.
Now, I don't know how far that'll get. I mean, that's very pre-production, but you know, it's we got Spielberg behind it. It's a big thing. I think it'll happen. But, mm-hmm. you know, between those two things and trying to bring back Hannibal in some form, Brian Fuller's a pretty busy guy. And I'll actually will say he's a pretty guy, too.
He's a very well-kept man.
I definitely – there aren't too many creators slash actors slash Hollywood famous people type that I could say that I would have a thing for. I mean, we've – you know, if you've really listened for a long time, you may know of my thing for Gillian Anderson. So we'll get to that. But I can definitely say Brian Fuller I kind of have a thing for. And it's not just because he spells his name the same way I do. But that is part of it, I think. Small part.
Well, what's funny, too, is like in the show Hannibal Lecter himself is a very well-dressed man.
Yes.
He is all about the suits, and he has mastered the plaid suit. And if you think that the idea of a plaid suit is kind of just no and too over the top, and Mads Mikkelsen pulled the damn thing off. And the reason why is because Brian Fuller basically dresses like that during his regular life.
Oh, he does. I mean, and I am totally not that person. Like, as a gay man, I definitely have some pretty weak clothing game, if you will. I don't do the suit thing. I don't do the dress up thing, really, unless I have to. But if I were to completely reinvent my look, I think that would be the way to go. I really do.
It's a very, very, I don't know, it's a sharp style.
It is. It's impressive. And you know, even if you don't, I mean, we are totally way off the rails already.
Talking about Hannibal.
Well, that's true. I want to get back to Pushing Daisies real quick, though. But even though, like, you know, you're in a situation where, let's say, you're a software engineer, maybe you work for the government or whatever, like, going to work in a suit, you're pretty much going to be a little out of place in most situations, but no one will ever say that you don't look good. You know what I mean? Like, even right. if you're not fitting the vibe of the office, you're still going to look pretty sharp.
Dressed man in the office.
Exactly. And I've started to realize that as I get a little older in my life. Now, back to Pushing Daisies. You need to watch it, first of all. I don't know how, as your older brother, I have let you get this far into your life without seeing it.
I mean, you definitely tried.
Yeah, but I think now you could get into it and actually appreciate it a bit more. Not because of the saccharine nature, because to be quite honest, there is that, but there's so much wit and beauty that isn't related to their romance, the two main characters in that. Of course, another Hollywood type that I admit a bit of a thing for. Lee Pace. Lee Pace. I kept wanting to say Lee Fuller. I think that's a bit of a wish fulfillment on somebody's part. Anyway.
He is on my man crush list, so.
he's pretty. But, like, you like him. And so, you know, that combined with Krista Chenoweth, and the love interest, Anna.
Oh, I don't even remember.
Yeah, crapping. Anyway, overall, great show. You need to watch it. So Hannibal is, especially coming from the same man who created that show, it is almost a complete 180 in tone, but not in style.
Right. Even though the style is entirely different, it is still brimming with the style that he likes.
Fuller is a visual, like, he demands a level of visual quality and cinematography that you just don't see in other television shows. Very influenced by Barry Sonnenfeld, I think, who also, like, I think he co-directed or directed the first episode of Pushing Daisies. But, like, there's, like, a through line if you kind of look at Fuller's work visually to other movie cinematographers. I mean, Fuller, even though he's a TV guy, could absolutely transition to the film world and do amazing stuff. Tar Sim, if you think of his visual style and cinematography that he brings to the movies, it's that kind of lush visuals, slow, lingering dolly shots.
And Tar Sim is also the one who did the Lee Pace starring movie, what was it, The Fall?
The Fall, yes, which is an amazing movie, another one of my favorites of his anyway. But so, like, there's this visual storytelling that Fuller does that's just magnificent. The other thing about Fuller's shows, and this is absolutely true of Hannibal, is his attention to detail on things that you don't maybe need, but it enriches the material. And in Hannibal, it's all about food and cuisine. And
it'll make every scene you see, because, of course, in the show, Hannibal is just – he's an accomplished surgeon. He's an accomplished cook. He is a master with a knife in his hands.
He plays the theremin.
He plays the theremin.
And the harpsichord, but you know.
But it's just that whole, you know, you're watching a cannibal turn people into food that'll make you hungry. Oh. And you have to reconcile that after the fact going, you know, I know what this is supposed to be, but it looks delicious.
I mean, and the reality of it, of course, is Fuller brought in at least one, but possibly several cuisine experts. One of them actually had a blog, I think the main one, and she would kind of talk about the various notes in the scripts. And sometimes Fuller actually would go to her, and I can't think of her name off the top of my head, but would go to her and say, I need something, and it's related to a leg. Like, do something really cool with somebody's leg. And she would go out and actually not only figure out what makes the most most cuisine, like, you know, what would be appropriate, but also prepared, I believe, at least the instructions on how to create something with, you know, other meats. I mean, a lot of that food you're seeing, of course, we, you know, if you suspend your disbelief, it's humans. It's long pork, to use the Harris phrase or the Hannibal phrase, but it's food. It's like, you know, they make it out of food that you could eat. And I mean, they eat it, so you hope that it's edible. So like that attention to detail that he brought in, Brian Reisel, who you may not have heard of before Hannibal. And I mean, if you're not a big soundtrack score person, you may not have heard of, but his music's very, very atmospheric. He's definitely like kind of a Mark Snow from X-Files and non-melodic, but can pull out melody, of course, if he needs to. But if you listen to the soundtracks of Hannibal, of which I think two of the seasons have come out, and there's actually like multi-disc for each season, they're lush and gorgeous, but like they're very atmospheric. I'll listen to them at work when I just want something in the background. I don't have to think about lyrics or melodies or hooks. And it's just awesome. It's atmospheric. You know, you think back as you hear certain cues, you think back to certain episodes and certain scenes. It's so, you know, Fuller brings nothing but the most proficient and creative types to his projects. And I think that's another reason it sort of sets everything apart, not the least including his actors.
Right.
I mean, we talked about Lee Pace. I mean, how we have things for him, but he's a fine and accomplished actor.
Mads Mikkelsen appeared on Hannibal.
What's that? Oh, yeah, I know.
Appeared on Hannibal.
We should talk about that too when we get to it. Mads Mikkelsen, let's start with him, because even though, I mean, the show is called Hannibal, so let's start with the guy who's taken on this role, made famous pretty much by
Casino Royale.
Oh yes, that's right. He is the James Bond villain. I was saying he took on this role that was made famous by Anthony Hopkins.
Oh yes,
in the movie franchises of Silence of the Lambs and that eventually made Red Dragon, but then Hannibal, the titular third book or whatever. So that's a tall challenge to take on a role like that, that has been so completely defined by another actor. And yet if I think Hannibal right now, after three seasons and to the extent that he did it, I don't think about Hopkins really much at all.
No, I mean, that movie, those series of films were done so long ago that though in like the popular zeitgeist, people might still reference the iconic lines that were made just for like Silence of the Lambs uttered by Lecter. But in the overall portrayal, you get much more of a well-rounded full character with the Mads Mikkelsen one, because you actually get much more of a almost like not the motivations behind him, but you understand his plight, and you kind of in some ways you agree when he looks at people who are just disrespectful or, you know, anybody like, you know, I'm not saying he's right for what he did, but he might not be as wrong as he should be.
They definitely color in the hues, because I mean, Anthony Hopkins up until Hannibal, I mean, he only done Silence before that. He's a villain. He's a pretty obvious, like, badass, evil person. There's not a lot of subtlety. You know, it's pretty much on the nose. You could liken him to maybe the Joker played by Jack Nicholson. Mm-hmm. Very comic book, you know, chewing the scenery kind of thing. But Mads doesn't do that. I mean, he is so understated, if anything. Like, he's like the Sheldon of serial killers, you know.
Oh, please don't. Please
well,
don't.
Only in the sense that I know people like that in my life, in my work. I know people who have that. And I mean, he'll never hear this, so I could probably say it without saying his name. But there is a coworker of mine who absolutely watches Hannibal, who has a partner who actually sort of looks at his obsession with these kind of shows. He loved Dexter. He loved Hannibal. I mean, and was a little concerned about his partner's
serial killer show. Oh, yes. Man, I love those. We got to watch that.
I mean, it's awkward when your partner says
with a notepad and a pen.
Are you doing stuff when I'm not here that involves this queen and a bone saw? What, like, what? I don't.
I always wondered why we had so many rolls of Saran wrap just laying around.
Yeah. So anyway, like, Mads is definitely sort of on that, like, very quiet, smoldering. There are later in the show. It spans three seasons, and you definitely get this arc of the character Hannibal, but you also get another arc that we'll talk about in a second of his kind of counterpart. But by the third season, I would definitely say Hannibal is starting to exhibit some pretty more like the Anthony Hopkins performance, but not as outlandish. Like, he never goes full on fava beans crazy. Like, I think one time he says something that is a little like crass, but you know, compared to the Anthony Hopkins stuff, like, no, Mads's Hannibal is the consummate sort of, I don't want to say gentleman, but
the understated. He doesn't have to just put it all out there. It's the double meaning of everything he says. That,
yes,
you know, there's the on the face meaning, and then there's the underlying, you know, more of the if you only knew my actual personality, you'd get the second meaning.
Yeah, the king of the multiple entendre.
Yes.
So the counterpart, of course, to this character Hannibal, and in the book's original book, Red Dragon,
kind of that's it.
Yeah, character. I mean, they expand upon this character a lot, but you have Will Graham, played by Hugh Dancy,
Mr. Claire Danes.
I forgot that. Actually, maybe I didn't even realize that. I don't know. Either way, not also if you're into the bearded gentleman sort of scholar. Again, kind of quiet, sympathetic, or, you know, he loves animals kind of guy. You could do worse.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe the serial killer tendencies or whatever is kind of bad. But again, nice to look at and seems pretty caring. Anyway, Hugh Dancy's Will Graham, all three seasons is definitely the counterpart. Sometimes, in fact, at the beginning, Friends, and we are going to spoil the show a little bit. So if you've never seen Hannibal, course, you probably don't want to maybe skip ahead or just come back after you finished.
This is a retrospective in that we're going to talk about all three seasons,
right? And we're not going to be cagey. Well, we're not going to be too cagey. There might be some things we leave out, of course, but we don't want you to be shocked when we say that Hannibal does X and Will do anyway.
Yeah.
Back to the matter though. Will is the protagonist of the series. If you really wanted to find somebody in the show that was like mostly the heroic person.
The person you're trying to root for, even though the show is called Hannibal. And so that does lend itself to ultimately being from Hannibal's perspective for a lot of things. But Will is kind of the hero that you hope at least is a good foil to Hannibal.
And in the beginning, they are introduced very much and they are colleagues. And there's even a doctor-patient relationship, you know, on top of a budding friendship. Some would even say bromance. Some really would say romance. I mean, Fuller, I think, in some of the interviews has said that they are very much he was exploring the extremes of male intimacy, non-sexual. Like,
right.
Really close friendships such that you lose your sense of identity into the other person. Like he really loved this idea. This is not in the books at all. This is totally contrived for this representation. But, you know, truth be told, and I have not read the book.
Well, Red books. Dragon?
Yeah, I haven't read Red Dragon. I haven't read Hannibal. I've read, I think, a little bit of Silence, but I need to. At some point, I do want to go back and read them, but they're a jumping off point.
Fuller said he, like, the whole reason why he came up with this show was pretty much Red Dragon. And he looked at all of the points in the book that they just gloss over or just reference, and he thought, I can fill in story there, I can fill in story there, because they don't expressly say one way or another.
Right.
And yeah, in Red Dragon, the only thing you know about Will Graham's relationship to Hannibal is that Will is the one who ultimately caught Hannibal.
Right.
And he, in the process, managed to get a very nasty slash across his stomach. And there's references in the process of, like, when Hannibal talks to him in jail that, you know, he basically – Hannibal makes it very clear that the only reason why Will caught him is because Will had more in common with him than Will would like to admit. And, like, that basis right there was all Brian Fuller needed to build what is, like, the architecture of the show.
And yet I will say that in later seasons, as much as – the promise of Red Dragon is fulfilled. They do the Red Dragon story masterfully, I think. They also make some pretty big departures from, I think, what you would need to do for continuity's sake with future books. For example, again, let's just go ahead and jump in here. You know, the characters that are in the background, there's a lot of great background supporting characters in the show.
One of them being Scott Thompson from Kids in the Hall.
Yes. And, you know, this is totally an aside, but if anyone's out there is a fan of the show or the movie Girls Will Be Girls, this is – I don't know, Jeff, if you've seen this. It's a three drag queens portray these three aging sort of women in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. Not aging. I guess one of them's not – too old. So you got Varla Jean Merman as the young ingenue. You've got Coco Peru as sort of one of the older sort of, you know, struggling to get by. And oh man, I can't think of his name. I just saw it. Anyway, I'll look that up while I talk. The they did a movie back in the mid 2000s, but I didn't realize until just the other day they've actually made like shortly thereafter, I think during the writer's strike.
2007.
Yes. They made what do you call it? They made a web series, like little webisodes. And one of them had Scott Thompson in from Kids in the Hall, of course, in awesome, like, you know, Kids in the Hall ish drag playing the mother of Coco Peru. And it was great. Like, you probably want to have seen the movie to really appreciate it, but, you know, you could watch the webisode and sort of just enjoy Scott Thompson. Jack Plotnick, who also more recently did what's that, Space 1979? What's that movie?
Oh, yes, the one with Patrick Wilson and is Liv Tyler in that one?
Yeah, I'm trying to find the name of the But
very kind of kitschy looking retro future indie film that came out like within the last couple of years.
Yeah, no, Jack, interesting guy, and plays one of the characters in the Girls with Girls, actually the sort of the main character. So, anyway, that was totally an aside about Scott Thompson, but in Hannibal he does play one of the forensic investigators at the FBI, of course, who Will Graham works with and, you know, sort of – oh, Space Station 76. That was the name of that place. Sorry. Okay. Look that up. Anyway, and so great choice. But he's – I don't even know if he's in the books, but he's not too much of like – I mean, he's – he doesn't have much of an arc. He's sort of there for comic relief, almost more than anything. Not too crazy. Nothing slapstick. Nothing. Again, this show doesn't do that, but sort of comic relief with his partner, whose name and character name is pretty forgettable, unfortunately. But like other characters, like Chilton. Okay, Dr. Chilton is in the Silence of the Lambs movie. He is the character who runs the Baltimore insane asylum or whatever, right. Whatever it's called in this TV rendering. He does eventually. No, he doesn't run it, but he's there a lot. And he's a big part of season two in it. But by season three, he's kind of been replaced. Yep. and messed up pretty badly.
Yeah, that the ongoing torture of Chilton, because like in the movies and in the books, like they don't really address like he has any kind of like speech impediments, or they just say he's very weird. He's very, you know, a star fucker.
Yes.
But for the, you know, criminally insane. And so, like, the season, every season, something horrible happens to him. He doesn't get killed. Spoiler, he never gets killed. But he gets more and more maimed throughout the show, to the point that at the end of the show, he is basically burned over like 99% of his body. He's missing the front of his face. His lips have been ripped off, and he's just not in a good way.
No, but I freaking love, I mean, in the movies it's like whatever, but it's an actor you've seen. He's a character actor. He does this and that. I can't think of his name, but
Raul Esparza.
Well, in the show it's by Raul Esparza. Esparza. If you've never seen him on Broadway or seen any of his Broadway stuff, he is a phenomenal singer and actor. I saw him first in Company, Sondheim's Company, and I think I had heard the soundtrack, and I was like, "Eh, it's okay." But when I watched that production, it was also the production where I believe they play their own instruments, mm-hmm. which is kind of a cool, like, you know, modern thing they started doing with some of Sondheim's stuff. It was really awesome to see that. Like the characters act and do their thing, and then they play instruments. It's just the whole thing. It's on PBS. It's on, I'm sure, like Netflix or Hulu. So if you want to look that up, but Raul Esparza is a phenomenal like actor. They brought him on the show again. This is Fuller bringing in all these great people, and he plays this total weasel.
completely. Like any time that there's an advantage that he can put out a book or get some fame out of the capture and then incarceration of any of these horrible, because that's the thing. Like the season one is basically a very case of the week kind of show.
Yeah.
It's very much Hannibal and Will are working for the FBI and tracking down these random killers that all seem to be living in or around the city of Baltimore.
Which was a little bit of contrivance. And they try to make it like make sense by saying that the Tattler, the
sort of crime.
Yeah. The website that is the what's her name?
Freddie Lowndes.
Who's
played by, I think he's a man and is even played by Philip Seymour Hoffman in the Red Dragon movie.
Right. But they adapted her as a woman in this, and she's running a website. I think the other one was like a, you know, tabloid. But
right. All
these killers are coming out of the woodwork because they're all inspired by the Chesapeake Ripper and the work of Will Graham to try to catch these people. So now that they see someone out there is publicly trying to catch these serial killers, they want to up their game to attract the attention of Will Graham. They play that storyline out a couple times,
mm-hmm.
and use the Tattler sort of in a way that it makes that sort of media commentary and media. How much is the media actually exciting and exacerbating these killers and what have you? So they play that a couple times in seasons. The other big departure from the continuity of the books and the movies they do is, of course, with the character who wants to kill and or consume Hannibal.
Dr. Abel Gideon?
Well, no, not Gideon. The rich heiress or heir and heiress.
Mason Verger.
Vergers. Okay, so the Verger storyline is something that you pretty much only ever see in the third book, in Hannibal.
Right.
But for some reason, they decided, let's bring this in early, and they surprised, I mean, again, this is a spoiler, but they surprised, I think, fans of the book when they basically play out the events, although heavily adapted, of Hannibal's, in the book Hannibal, Verger captures Lecter. And they play the whole thing out where he gets his comeuppance for trying to outdo Hannibal Lecter.
Right.
I think when they did that, it sort of the jumping off points Red Dragon, and they're trying to do the prequel. But it became obvious that they were like, okay, well, you know, let's bring in some of this other material and let's try to do something that we may or may not ever want to or get to. Do you know what I mean? Like,
and I wonder if, and this is kind of speaking to the limitations that this show ultimately had, is I wonder if a lot of plot points were made because behind the scenes, they were not ever really able to secure the rights to Clarice Starling.
That is a big thing, yeah.
And that is, I mean, she was the main protagonist for the second and the third book, even through like this Mason Verger stuff. So because they could never lock her down, they kind of had to like basically do not a tap dance, but change things around where Will became the focus wholly, instead of being able to say, well, maybe Will's still there and he's helping out, but there's also Clarice here as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's and I don't know that I've actually ever read why they brought that in as much as, you know, that, I mean, obviously they did, but it certainly shows that they were not hand bound to, like, they weren't slaving to the continuity. They weren't trying to, adapt the movies or the books in any kind of authoritarian sort of like, we are going to stick to the story way. And to their credit, because, you know, though that can work well in some cases, most of the time these adaptations are not served by being slaves to the books.
Yeah, and it doesn't do them any favors in terms of being able to put their own spin on the story or even help with surprises or, you know, it ultimately it handcuffs them more than it helps them.
Absolutely. And it can run them into the ground. Now, back to Will Graham, because I think we jumped off a bit with that. Will Graham is, of course, an FBI agent. He isn't actually a special agent. He's a consulting agent, because his psyche eval didn't let him basically go through the typical program that they would go through. But he is so talented at profiling these serial killers that he actually starts teaching at Quantico to help train these students, these FBI agents to become good, to catch the criminals. And so
I think when Red Dragon came out, I don't think the idea of the FBI profiler was as common as it is now.
Oh, no. Hannibal or Will Graham is, I think, fictionally one of the first, and it sort of popularized that idea that then you saw in other media like X-Files and Millennia and other various things. But I mean, the core idea here is that they have such a good imagination and or they are so empathetic to the stories of the people that they're trying to catch that they can put themselves in their prey's head, so to speak.
Like in basically, yeah, it puts them in their mindset.
Right. It, again, it's imagination, but it's also total empathy is the thing they play out with Will Graham.
And that's kind of the nice burden of his the curse of his powers, if you want to go superhero on this, because it's like the things he does to put his mindset into that of the criminal or the serial killer takes such a toll on him that it's hard to shake when he's put himself there.
Yeah.
And he kind of carries it with him.
It is a burden because like he just can't turn it off. It's just haunting him at night, and also suggests that he is prone to his, you know, darker tendencies. And so there's a theme in the show, and mainly in the second season more than anything, but it certainly starts in the first season, where even Will Graham could not tell you if he wasn't somewhat to blame for some of these murders that they haven't explained or haven't caught, so much so that they end up accusing him of these murders, of some of the murders of the Chesapeake Ripper. In the second season, he is basically locked up, very, very reminiscent of Hannibal Lecter, in the whole face mask, being wheeled around in the sanatorium or the sane asylum, and sort of being the suspect of all this stuff. And it's because people see him and just go, God, this guy's crazy. He's unhinged. And oh my God, he's at the right place at the right time so many times that there must be something going on. Of course, the viewer knows midway through season one, if not before, that Hannibal is kind of setting him up to some extent to be this.
Yeah.
To take the fall.
That's kind of the oddness of the relationship over the whole series, is that Hannibal in the beginning of the series, you think is basically trying to set Will up as the fall guy so that he can kind of continue going on and not get caught as the Chesapeake Ripper. But then as the show goes on, you realize it's like he's trying to open Will up to the possibility that he and Hannibal are much more similar than Will wants to be able to admit it. But then he's also looking for that ultimate like soulmate in his serial killer nature. So it's like he's looking for companionship, but he also doesn't mind it if it lines up with the fact that, hey, well now people aren't going to suspect me as the killer. So it's kind of like a twofold reason why all this is happening.
I mean, it kind of speaks to the sociopath or psychopath, I never get those right, of Hannibal, where he sees the utility of Will Graham, but he also is attracted to the sympathy of Will Graham. That, like you said, he can sort of understand Hannibal's vocation, if you will, his life, his expression.
Right.
Consummating it in, I think it was season two?
Yeah.
When basically Will Graham accidentally or whatever, he's defending himself and he kills a guy. But because, and this is of course after he's been released and he's no one, well, they can't legally charge him because they realize he didn't actually kill. He's not the Chesapeake Ripper. He didn't do all those murders, but he finds himself in a situation where he is attacked and then defends himself, kills the guy, and then prepares the guy that he killed in the way that Hannibal would have prepared, or as a sort of a, it's almost like two musicians trading duets or trading solos, if you will. And like one will play a riff and the other one will play a riff that sort of uses that and sort of expands it and complements it. Like total, you know, admiration, mutual admiration kind of thing, which at that moment when he does this, it's pretty dark and you're like, oh, well, protagonist is being stretched a bit far now.
Right. Yeah.
And then they continue on that in season three. They have him basically somebody else, another character we haven't really talked about yet, but she kills a guy, you know, that he kind of facilitated a little bit, that Will Graham is facilitating. So like there's this theme now after two instances of him, you know, the second one where he dolls up this guy that's killed into a way that Hannibal would have killed and or what it would have done, like showing that Will Graham, even if he is empathetic of Hannibal, now he is starting to manifest that and do it himself.
Right.
So one of the things you mentioned, though, like sort of that the way that all plays out, there's another character that comes along. Actually, there's a couple psychologists into this mix, and they're background characters to a certain extent, but they become pretty prominent in by the end, and if not earlier. One of them that, you know, I have a bit of a thing for is, of course, played by Gillian Anderson from X-Files.
As she plays, of all things, and you think like at the beginning when she's introduced, like, okay, maybe she just drew the really, really unlucky short straw because she is the therapist for Hannibal Lecter.
Well, but I mean, and she is, of course, and that's how you introduced to her. But there's so much more than that to her right. relationship with Hannibal.
As
you come to find out, there is certainly. There's this idea that Hannibal Lecter is sort of an influencing sort of character, like
he's the devil on your shoulder.
Yeah. And that's what Fuller even said. Fuller's like, no, Hannibal Lecter, he's not just a sociopath. He's the devil. He will lead you down these paths to make these bad decisions and do these terrible things. That's his job, to corrupt. And so he corrupts Bedelia du Maurier, Dr. Bedelia's character. To the extent that she ultimately ends up killing one of her own patients and then kind of freaks out and calls Hannibal and is like, oh my God, I accidentally, well, at first it's sort of an accident. You're not sure what happened, but they eventually show it and you're like, no, she pretty much stuck her fist down the guy's throat.
Yeah. It was one of those, like it was a killing of convenience. 'Cause basically like the guy has a seizure where he swallows his tongue. So she, in the beginning, like as the scene plays out, you're like, okay, so at this point, there's that line where she could be going in to help kind of get his tongue from the, make sure he's not swallowing his tongue. But then she just crams her whole fist down his throat and basically kills him.
So if you're a fan of fisting, it's not what you might think, but it's got an element of similar, and it's gross. Like that scene isn't done until season three. And the guy she orally fists is what's his name? Skyler.
Zachary Quinto.
Yeah, Zachary Quinto. I mean, Scully is fisting through the mouth Spock. It's kind of weird. And yeah. This show, like,
you have to at least give it to NBC, like, and whatever, however Brian Fuller managed to pull it off, where that this show aired at 10 o'clock on Friday nights at the end of it, but I think it was not a Friday, I think it was like a Thursday night show for the first two seasons.
They moved it to Friday to Saturday. They moved it a lot in the schedule, but yeah.
But yeah, it was just a 10 o'clock show, and yet NBC gave them carte blanche in a lot of ways to do a lot of different stuff that you don't think should air on like a network television channel.
From the beginning, I was sitting there, Pat and I watched the whole season, the whole series together, and I just could not believe that this was a show I was watching on a basic cable network in Safe Harbor, of course, you know, after the point where kids should be in bed and whatever. But that it was on television and it wasn't edited, I was shocked. I mean, I wasn't super offended or like grossed out. I'm, of course, pretty jaded about all that now. But it's because I've seen other shows on not basic cable, like that a basic cable show would do this is unprecedented, I think. And dealing with really dark subject matter consistently. I mean, there's nary an episode that goes by that somebody isn't killed. And killed brutally and artistically. I mean, again,
and it's dwelled on and kind of focused on, and like you said, very artistic. Like they take some long, lingering shots of things that you should not be doing on prime time.
I'm trying to think. I can't even tell you what the worst of it is, but certainly one of the most disturbing scenes in the first season I remember was there were people buried alive. In a like a compost bed for mushrooms.
Yeah, they basically had like the fungus used the body to kind of grow, and the people are still alive.
Yeah,
throughout this whole process, they're put into like a almost like a medically induced coma.
They're diabetic and they go into, you know, shock of low blood sugar, but they're kept barely alive as sort of living zombies,
just to feed mushrooms.
It's horrific. And visually, it's pretty gross because one of the people, of course, that when they discover it, you know, actually wakes up and is alive for a mm-hmm. little bit. But like, if you think about it, it's horrific. So like, they take, and you know, that's on the more like mental, like, you know, intellectual level. You're like, oh god, that would be awful. Then you have people's limbs just getting cut off, blood going everywhere, and then it being served, in high cuisine style, back to them. Mm-hmm. Like fed to the okay, so let's so I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the other amazing background characters. I want to get to Abel Gideon because that's the one I'm sort of I was getting all excited about.
Played by Eddie Izzard.
Eddie Izzard, who I just
came to Orlando,
missed. I had said to myself years ago, if Eddie Izzard ever comes to Orlando, I'm gonna go see him. If you've never seen Eddie Izzard's comedy, you are missing out. Not only is he an incredibly talented comedian, but he does this gender bending executive transvestite thing. At least he used to. I don't know if he does it as much.
I think he still does.
Does he still? But he's a heterosexual, you know, guy. And this is by no means saying that you couldn't be, but he is absolutely a transvestite. Like he dresses in women's clothing and makeup and drag because he feels empowered by it, but he's not a homosexual. So I think for some gay people, it's odd, you know, when heterosexuals do drag, but it's totally a valid thing. And he does it and does an amazing job of it, looking phenomenal, but then coming out and doing really funny British sort of comedy. He just
when like as an actor though, like I remember his first couple of roles, like he was in the really cheesy movie Mystery Men as one of the goons. But going from that to like this, like he is basically his character on Hannibal is almost like he took credit for the Chesapeake Ripper kills, but no one in the FBI ever really thought he was the Chesapeake Ripper. He just started taking credit for the kills. And in the process, like he did this, his character did murder his wife, I believe, on his own. And that was legitimate.
Not just wife and family.
Wife and yeah, that's right. It was like a holiday meal.
It's pretty awful.
But the fact that like everything else that the character goes through, it's just this enthralling performance that, like, you can't take your eyes off of it. And he's actually, like, the almost like the proto Hannibal that Will first comes up against in the run of the show.
Yeah, he's already institutionalized at the time that he's introduced. And Chilton has been what they call it psychic driving. He's basically been convincing this inmate who did earn his way into this facility for criminal insane criminals, criminally insane criminals.
Just to reiterate.
Yeah. He is so convinced that he is a Chesapeake Ripper because Chilton basically kind of wants him to be. It's unclear if it's strictly for his own benefit, but I mean, it's basically Chilton's whole arc is everything he does is to pretty much further his own career mm-hmm. and to make money off of these insane people. But he kills a nurse, like, really, really awful, brutal. That's another episode where the opening is really visceral and bloody and horrible when you really see how this poor nurse gets killed. And he does that, but he does that because he thinks that that's now his thing. He's this ripper and proceeds to escape and do some terrible things that sort of try to validate him as the ripper. Until, of course, now Hannibal Lecter, who is the Chesapeake Ripper, sees all this and is enraged because, of course, he wants to get the credit for his kills.
Right.
Comes for Gideon and takes him out. And the arc of that is really fascinating because they sort of deal with what is actually happening, I think, up through the second season. And he's taken out, like he's done away with. But in the third season, you actually see more of the
flashbacks.
You see the back, yeah. You see, like, oh, this is what happened, and that Lecter catches Gideon, and proceeds to feed him and fatten him up like you would a prized hog or heifer to slaughter, and you want to make them as tasty as possible. Like, does all this, and they portray it, and they show Gideon understanding what Hannibal's doing while he's being fed these, like, snails, some kind of snails. I forgot what the deal is, but, like, snails fed some fancy thing that Gideon then eats so that Hannibal then can take his meat, his leg and his whatever, and then serve it back to him.
Yeah.
It's like, again, you see the visceral awfulness. You see the beauty of the preparation of the thing. And then you deal with the psychological horror that is eating your own flesh and yet being in complete, like, no control. You kind of have to do it. Because if you don't do it, then you're rude to Hannibal. He'll just kill you. He'll outright murder you sooner.
Right. So, this is almost like I'm showing you the respect of treating you, you know, basically turning into a very, very fine piece of cuisine. And if you disrespect me, well, then I'll just butcher you and have, you know, I'll turn you into hamburgers.
Basically. No, and the way Hannibal disposes of you is sort of a sign of how he views you. Like, if you are just meat, you know, he may slaughter you and just prepare you in some whatever way. But, like, certain people that he respects, like, even Will Graham at some point, like, he respects and empathizes and loves so much that, you know, he at one point wants to serve him up in a way that is very special and very throwback to Hannibal, I think. He's trying to carve open his skull.
Yeah.
And
yeah, that was out of the
Ray Liotta character, and he's wanting to eat his brains or whatever. Like, you know, again, that was more of a show of respect, I think, than, like, other characters. But with Gideon not only portrays this proto-Hannibal, that Eddie Izzard brings this non-comedic and totally non-comedic role, but does it just in a way that is, like, more like a Hannibal Lecter character almost than Hannibal Lecter is really cool. And that's a total new thing. Like, they added that completely. I think partly because Eddie Izzard, of course, had a relationship with Fuller from the reboot of the Munsters.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about
Mockingbird
that.
Lane, I think. Something.
That was basically the, you know, the not the world's biggest, but one of the most remarkable recent memory, just completely failed TV pilots.
Which, I mean, and it's another Fuller thing. And if you like Fuller, you'll see lots of it in the project. And what's his name? Eddie Izzard played Grandpa.
Yeah, Grandpa.
The very Nosferatu sort of vampiric member of the Munsters. in Eddie Izzard or in Fuller's adaptation, like total brutal evil, like vampire, you know, consuming like the life force of these people so that he could be made young. But yet, I mean, that relationship, I think, to Fuller made him more, you know, oh, let's bring you into the show. Let's give you something interesting to do. Let's make you this proto Hannibal type character, and let's throw you into the mix with Hannibal, with Will Graham, with these other people, and let's see how you play. And that's again where the spirit of the show is there. The spirit of the Harris stuff is there, but they take great liberties and they make new art from that. Another character that they did more with is Jack Crawford. Jack Crawford is a huge part of these movies, pretty much, I think, all of them. I'm not sure about Hannibal as much, but definitely Red Dragon and Silence. He's like the puppet master at the FBI using these agents to catch serial killers, but almost like psychologically manipulating them to some extent to get what he needs.
Yeah, you do have a lot more empathy in the show. So yeah, he's like in the movie, it's very much a, you can tell the machinations are the wheels are turning whenever he's setting up, when he's trying to get Clarice and do something in Silence of the Lambs. And in the show, he's very much one of these, like, he's very put upon. You see a traumatic incident with another agent where the Chesapeake Ripper claims her pretty early on, all due to Jack kind of putting her on that collision course with him. And then you see him be very reticent to make. He knows Will's advantages about why he would be such a good person to use, but he also knows the downside of, well, if I do this, Will is probably not going to come back unscathed.
And that's
has to do it anyway.
Right. That's the cost that he's willing to make over and over again. I mean, it's not just like one time where people are like, hey, you know, you're messing with this guy's head. He does it quite a lot, and even in the end, the third season, even though he basically knows that Jack or that Will be damaged, will just continually let him do what he's going to do and push him in the right directions. What is kind of cool with played by Lawrence Fishburne in this all three seasons, Jack's wife.
Played by his real life wife.
Oh, wait,
Gina Torres.
I didn't know that. Oh, that's I did not realize that.
That is his real life wife.
It is one of those, again, storylines that you don't. There's no basis in the books, but oh my God, Gina Torres, from a lot of our geeky fans, of course, know her from Firefly. She's Wash's wife, and I can't think of the character's name.
I can't remember either.
Yeah, but she's awesome. She's like a badass in the in the show. She is like dying of terminal cancer, and I like, you know, you meet her, and pretty much from the beginning, like I think it's the very first episode she's in, you know, that's what's happening. Cause I mean, they reveal it over the time, but like she has this arc of learning to come to terms with her cancer, but also to try not to ruin her relationship with her husband, but yet that's how it starts to happen. And then she actually goes to Hannibal and is like, please kill me. You know, take me out, because I can't keep being this to my husband. I don't want this to be the relationship we have. I want to leave having this amazing relationship with my husband and da da da. And then yet going through this whole up and down, you know, where she thinks she's being killed, but Hannibal actually brings her back, mm-hmm. because of, I think it was like a capricious, like, flip of a coin, you know, like, oh, I should let her die. Wait, no, I'm not going to let her die.
Yeah. That would raise too many questions. That would put too much suspicion on me.
Yeah. And then, comes back and is still suffering from this terminal lung cancer. And ultimately Jack has to put her out of her misery. Which is pretty. I mean, it's tender. It's not a. This is one of the parts of the show that's very tender and amazingly dramatic and touching. And you deal with this sense of death in a show that's all about death, but in a very personal way.
Yeah.
They've put this storyline in. Her character in Firefly was Zoe, my friend of ours from high school's daughter's name is Zoe. I don't know why I can't keep Zoe in my head for some reason, but yeah, Zoe Washburn. Zoe Wash. is the character she played. So, like, phenomenal. Like, again, not a huge part, background character, but just another thing in this amazing series that isn't in the books, isn't in the movies, but, like, they wrote into it, and it feels organic to the show.
Yeah.
Like, that, again, Fuller's beauty, his magic of television is that this is episodic. You do pretty much need to keep up week to week. It's villain of the week, monster of the week in the first season, but you still have an ongoing story, and that story just keeps building throughout the whole run.
It's like a lot of good shows you see now, is they use that first season to kind of make a serial, or to world build and do a case of the week thing, and then by the second or third season, then they really kind of run with it and say, all right, well, anybody that isn't on now, we're just going to keep going, and we're going to make this more of a serialized. And you also kind of have to, because you go that long with storylines, you're going to build a lot of ancillary details into an overarching story.
Right.
But yeah, like, so we could sit here and talk all day about all the different characters, but ultimately, you know, what ended up happening with Hannibal, unfortunately, is the viewership was just not there. So I think Fuller said in an interview, by like mid season three, or in the beginning, when he had finished shooting about half of the season, he was kind of more or less told by the heads at NBC that it's like, okay, look, things aren't looking good. Maybe you should get to a point that would be good for you to conclude things as well as you would like.
Right.
Like, they didn't let him just kind of sit him in a lurch, much like other shows have notoriously done, like, you know, the Deadwoods and other shows where they don't have a chance to conclude anything.
Well, what's funny is I read an interview with Fuller where he's like, you know, we would have ended season three the way we ended it, regardless of how season four would have turned out. Like, the season three ending was a season three ending, but given the hindsight that it was the end of the show, they knew that it would also work well as a series ender.
Right.
Because it finishes the Red Dragon arc with the amazing Richard Armitage as Francis Dollarhyde. And it lets them tell the whole prequel. So they did the prequel, and then they do Red Dragon. And even though in the books and the movie, you know, Will Graham catches Hannibal and then kind of goes in retirement, basically, with the family that they introduce in season three. In the big departure, I mean, this was a huge departure in the television show they chose to make. Keeping true to this idea that Will Graham and Hannibal have this sort of bromance, this sort of duality, they ultimately kill Dollarhyde's character after going through the events of Red Dragon pretty strictly and accurately from the books and the movie. They both, Will and Hannibal, kind of come together at that last moment and kill Dollarhyde, and Hannibal's like, look, this is what I've been trying to tell you. Isn't it amazing? Isn't it awesome how killing feels? And like, you've now seen sort of where I get my thing from. You can appreciate it more, you know. And basically, they kind of let it breathe a little bit that Will actually does enjoy it, that he does recognize that. But
of course, as soon as he does acknowledge that, then he decides to pull a Sherlock Holmes Reichenbach Falls level ending and throw himself and Hannibal off the edge of a cliff.
Mm-hmm.
So that you know if he can't because he knows he could never really arrest and take Hannibal in and be okay and just let it go and move on with his life. So he's like, all right, well, fuck it, we're both gonna go down. If I'm going down, if I can't live with you in jail, then I'm just gonna have to not live either way.
And this is after, midway through the third season, Hannibal is put in and gives himself up, basically, because of some of the events that have happened. But he does so that Will will always know where he is. So Will basically rejects him and is like, look, I don't want anything to do with you anymore. But Hannibal's like, but I know you will, you know, in this one case, if I am in prison and something comes up that you need me. So again, Hannibal,
like,
always,
you'll be back.
Yeah. I mean, it's the spurned ex-girlfriend, ex-boyfriend, whatever, but laying the foundation for, look, you'll know where to find me, and you will find me again when you need me.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, there's this level of manipulation that from the very beginning of season one all the way up through the end of season three is present to try to get Will to be what Hannibal wants him to be. And Will plays along with it, like, you know, really plays along with it in some points to use it to catch Hannibal, like the best bait is a live lure kind of thing.
Right.
And they do that whole fishing metaphor in season two, but also to inadvertently sort of go down Hannibal's path and become more like Hannibal. So it's again, it's masterful. The show is even though it did not continue, and there is an attempt to get it to come back as either a movie or a miniseries or something. Fuller has not given up on the show. De Laurentiis, the production people behind it, they have not given up on it. They had financed it through NBC and Sky One, which is a, I think, British cable network.
Yeah, actually, I think Sky One also did some financing for Battlestar Galactica.
Yes, yeah. So the idea is they jointly pay for the show that then gets aired here on, you know, on NBC, and then there on whatever Sky One's network. They're looking at other financing models. They're trying to see if there's a way to bring it back. Of course, Mads Mikkelsen is going to be all over the place soon. He's going to be in Doctor Strange. He's going to
be in Star Wars.
Star Wars Rogue One. He's going to be probably showing up in a lot more movies. I mean, he had been a movie star prior to that in some minor roles, but he's definitely, I think, through this show, transformed into some other kind of level. But getting him back, I mean, he's made his thing off this role. I think he's even said he's like, I'd come back to it gladly.
Well, it also helps that he and Hugh Dancy are, you know, really, really close friends in real life.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Oh,
yeah, they were in that really bad King Arthur movie.
Oh, they were both in that? Okay.
Yeah, because I know Hugh Dancy played Percival. Oh. I forget who Mads played, but yeah, that's where they originally met. And Hugh Dancy is the one who recommended Mads to play Hannibal.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Well, that's cool. So, like, that's one of those things where you just go, if you're like one of those and I say Tumblr people in this case, with all due deference and respect, if you like the romantic angle of Hannibal and you like making your shipping, you know, the two of them together romantically on Tumblr, like, this is a nice thing to think about in real life, like that they actually are, you know, pretty good friends and probably not as romantic.
But like you said with Mads, though, it's the ultimate riddle of Deadwood, where everybody swears, oh, well, we'd like to wrap it up. But then it's like, OK, well, everybody here now is a major name in some fashion. So right. How the hell do we get everybody to have an opening in their schedules enough to bring back to do?
They're bringing back X-Files. Like, this is to me the proof.
How long did that take?
It took a long time, but they brought back Heroes, which wasn't as long. They brought back X-Files. Now is an age where this stuff could happen because there's so many other financing models with, you know, great cable, great internet-based, you know, all these different venues. It's not just major networks.
Yeah.
So I have a good feeling that it probably will come back in some form someday.
Eventually.
But they do – getting the rights to Clarice would be a huge win because – they could then weave her into this tapestry. But, you know, one of the interviews I read, because, I mean, again, pulling both of those characters off the cliff, the Reichenbach Falls thing, basically Fuller's like, neither one has to be dead. Right. They do a post-credits shot, which they then adapted as a PETA commercial, I found out. I don't know if you saw this.
No.
Gillian Anderson's character, Bedelia, like, she escapes in season three. She somehow managed to escape Hannibal even after she – kind of, you know, thought that she might end up, you know, meeting him for dinner, if you will. But the post-credits scene of season three after they fall off the falls implies that Hannibal does survive and comes back. And you see this beautifully prepared leg of lamb or leg of something.
Well, it implies more than that.
Well, right, because I guess what? It's a table setting for three?
Uh-huh. There were two open table settings, and it's basically Bedelia has cut her own leg off.
Well,
if you look at it in a certain way, basically her leg has been prepared and is sitting there on the table, and she has poured some wine for herself and is about to drink, but you don't know. There are two more place settings waiting for her.
Right.
So that's the end cap on the series to give – basically to kind of in the best sense think, okay, well, you know, the story continues.
And Fuller said that – I mean, I just read this today. He actually said the most interesting chapter of Will Graham's life is yet to come. So, like, unless that's just a total, like, you know, inspired by Will Graham kind of thing, like, both of them could be completely alive and off doing amazing adventures together. Like, it's one of those ambiguous endings that isn't quite as ambiguous as like a Sopranos or something, but you could so certainly imagine whatever you want. from the ending, which is why I think, honestly, if they don't make any more, I'm okay with the ending they've got.
Yeah. I know that, like, my theory, as Fuller talked about all the crazy thoughts he would do for season four, I always considered, like, well, what if by – because this is before I knew the end of the series as it was. Like, well, what if by the end Hannibal does finally kill and consume Will, but then the show going forward is Will is the kind of literal voice in Hannibal's head.
Yeah.
Not to do the right thing, but as, like, a reminder of something in his nature that has been passed on to Hannibal now.
Yeah. The transubstantiation sort of idea there. No, I think that's great too. I mean, there's so many interesting ways that they could take it. And I think Fuller is such a great creative force for this. He's just really busy. So I'm kind of like, well, you know, maybe someday they'll come back to it, but you
it
know.
Just makes you really hopeful, but also nervous about American Gods. Because I've noticed, and this, like I said, at the beginning of the podcast, like, this is my first Fuller show that I've been like as big on as ever I've seen you with other ones. It is almost like a fatal love with Fuller shows,
because most of them don't make it past one or two seasons. Although, you know, Dead Like Me made it
two seasons.
No, Dead Like Me went further than that. Dead Like Me was like four or five or four, three. I don't know. It went further than the other ones. Wonderfalls was not even full season. Pushing Daisies was not even two full seasons, although the writer's strike was part of that.
Mm-hmm.
And then this one was three seasons. So, I mean, three limited, you know, half seasons, if you will.
Yeah, no, but, Dead Like Me was only two seasons.
Really?
Yeah, it was only two.
I swear it was longer. Maybe because Showtime spaced it out more or something, but...
Yeah.
Well, then they made the movie too, but he had left after. Anyway, long story short, you're right. Hannibal or Fuller, he's not always the most like populist.
He's got great ideas, but it's hard to bring the viewership.
Yes, it's a little too stylized. I know some people I talked to for season three, they were just bored to tears because they thought it was far too expansive and sort of slow building and everything.
Well, the first half is definitely a kind of a rumination on the ideas put forth in the Hannibal book.
But,
and it's almost like Fuller wanted to show – he wanted the setting to be like in Italy as much of a character of the show as the rest of the actual characters.
And it totally was. I mean, like, it's beautiful, like the way they shot it and the scenes they used. So one thing we have not said, and we should probably wrap up after this, the idea of the series was for each season to sort of be sort of a psychic sequel or – heavily influenced by each book, each movie. Mm-hmm. So the first series is very much influenced and directed by sort of the ideas of Red Dragon, even though it's not the plot. The second series is very Silence of the Lambs, and you have that with Will being locked up and treated as like this criminal, insane, whatever, but also like people come to him for help. The third season starts, at least the first half, is very much influenced by Hannibal because, well, Hannibal and Bedelia are back in Italy on the run, and you get the Verger stuff. We didn't really get too into that, but basically they play out the Hannibal stuff of Mason Verger and his sister. But Marco. Again, with some major alterations.
Yeah.
And then the second half of season three, of course, is Red Dragon, and that plays out very much like Red Dragon. Having just recently seen that movie, after watching the show, I was like, oh my God, they really were like they adapted this pretty close.
They tried to honor it as best they could.
Other than the ending, which again, I haven't talked to too many Dyed in the Wool Tom Harris fans, but I have a feeling like if that was still their thing and they didn't buy into the show, that would be a pretty big departure for them.
But
great show. We've kind of spoiled the hell out of it, but you know, even if you know how it ends, I'm telling you right now, watching the show beat by beat, things will still shock you and surprise you, and you'll just be sitting there, you know, in awe of the beauty and the horrible, horrible psychological horror that is so many of the killings.
Yeah.
It sounds weird to advocate for something that's so dark, but
it's dark in that if you like dark chocolate, it's the same thing. There's a richness and a deliciousness to the darkness.
Yeah, and you will come away appreciating maybe the macabre a bit more, and not in a crafts way, but in just sort of a craftsmanship way. I mean, as much as people got really excited by Dexter killing serial killers, like, he was pretty brutal about it. It was pretty, like, you know, nothing too artistic. This,
right.
Everything in this, these sort of shows, art. And if you are a fan of the beauty of art, music, visuals, cuisine, whatever, like, there's a lot here for you just to sit back and enjoy, as long as, again, you can sort of let the more macabre elements, you know, be a part of that, which,
yeah,
I don't know. Some people then get worried that their partners are serial killers because they
you like know, it. Then, you know, you just sleep with one eye open.
Basically. Yes.
Yeah.
So yeah, though, that's Hannibal, and they're all, I think season 3 is coming out real soon if it's not already out.
And then Amazon, I think, has the exclusive distribution rights after the fact. So what'll probably end up happening once it does get released is you'll have the full season, full 3 seasons on Amazon Prime to watch.
So you can go watch Man in the High Castle, and then you can watch Hannibal. Both mm-hmm. two great shows, totally different, but both well executed, and both with a lot of X-Files DNA in them. So definitely, please check that out if you haven't already. Let us know what you think. Of course, we're on flameonshow.com, flameonshow on Facebook, flameonpodcast on Twitter, and you can, email all of us, with our first names, Brian and Jeff, both separately at flameonshow.com. We'd love to hear from you. We'd love to know what you thought of Hannibal. We'd love to have any other show recommendations. I mean, we try to talk about a lot of pop culture and especially TV on the show, but if you have any shows that we've missed or that are coming out that you think we should check out, please let us know and we'll talk about it. And if you have any questions or anything else you want us to discuss on the show, we are always welcoming of your listener feedback. So please hit us up on social media or via email, and we will reference your question in the show.
All right.
So thanks again for listening. I know this is normally a full cast recording, but with the holidays and with various people being out having adventures or recuperating from their adventures, we wanted to mix it up a little bit. I believe the next episode we have will be a recap show, so you can check out some of the best of Flame On over the past 100 episodes, I think. I don't remember how far back we're going for our recap show, but we will be back with brand new pop culture review and stuff, and I believe we'll be talking about Star Wars. I mean,
yeah, probably.
Let's face it. Well, and Jessica Jones. That's another one we got to do.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
So
we have no shortage of material.
Well, pop culture just keeps on going. That's just a train you just kind of let. It leaves the station every 5 minutes. No, I mean we'll be doing separate shows, I think, for both topics. So when you after the new year comes around, when we have our new episodes, you'll get to hear what we thought of these interesting and awesome things over the holidays. So stay tuned. Again, Flame On Show, and we'll soon be on the Googles. I think they're doing their podcast thing very soon. We've submitted. So if you like the Google, look for that on Google Play's podcast listing. We should be up there as soon as they release it.
All right.
So thanks again. And on that note,
flame off.
Thanks for listening to Flame On, a podcast made possible by Powder Milk Biscuits, the ones in the blue box, a comic shop, and the generous support of Tops and Bottoms like you. If you want to be one of our sugar daddies, you can help out by telling a cute single friend about us, reviewing us on iTunes, or putting some dollars down our digital G-string in our monthly support drive. For more ridiculously entertaining and socially enlightening episodes of Flame On, as well as other fine programs, head on over to nerdyshow.com. You can subscribe to Flame On and all Nerdy Show Network podcasts via iTunes. And be sure to find us on Twitter at Flame On Podcast or Facebook on our Flame On fan page. And make sure to check out flameonshow.com for more nerdy queer in your ear.